The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Yeah, good morning, everyone. You know, it is sometimes not very motivating to speak after meditating. But I am sitting in this speaking spot. So I have been thinking a bit or practicing with these two major areas of mindfulness. One is the part that's more cognitive, and the other is the part that's more feeling, sense-based. One is more mind-based, and the other is more body-based. And different people will specialize in one of these two areas of mindfulness. Some people can do both, but it's important to have a sense of both so they can be partners in this endeavor of waking up, of being present. And the simple representation of the cognitive side of mindfulness is what's called mental noting, or recognizing, a kind of seeing, knowing what's happening clearly. And sometimes, maybe some of you have had the experience of having someone else do that cognitive work for you, that, you know, someone you might be kind of having a little challenging time or preoccupied with something, and a friend who is completely concerned with your well-being only might say something simple like, "You seem tense," or "You seem, you know, preoccupied." And someone did the cognitive work for you. They saw what was going on. They recognized, and they named it for you. And maybe then, oh, okay, yeah, it's true. I guess I am. And only then do you stop and take that into account. So there is this part of knowing, the clear, and sometimes that's very, very powerful. And in mindfulness practice, the deeper the practice goes, the more valuable the knowing becomes. And some people, of course, are caught up in their cognitive mind. Some people are trapped in their thoughts. Some people are spinning around and just navigating and negotiating a swirl of thinking. And that probably was the case even back in the time of the Buddha. He has this very dramatic metaphor of being swept away by the floods. And in the modern world, sometimes, I don't know if it's still the case, but it was when I was young, there was a metaphor of thought trains, that you're coming along and the train guard comes down and you have to wait for the train to go by. And at some point you realize, wait a minute, I'm on the train. How did I get here? So the thought trains that we get caught in, and it can be, you know, some months or years before we get off some of these trains. And but the Buddha talked about floods, the floods coming through. We're flooded by these thoughts, and they can overwhelm us and drown us even sometimes. And I've seen it happen to me a little bit when I spend too much time on a screen, sometimes doing too much screen work, sometimes doing just searching the screen, reading the news, or doing some research that I do. There's something happens in my... It's very cognitive to do that screen work for me. And so the thinking mind, or not exactly the thinking mind, but the part of the cognitive mind that's searching, that's looking, that's wanting, that's jumping to the next thing, that's kind of not settled. is looking for something, wanting something all the time. What's next? There, not there, not there. Click, 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 click. Do a search, do this. And that does, I can feel that it affects my brain, my mind. And I'm kind of start, I don't recognize it. Sometimes there's even a little bit of pleasure to it. But I start feeling that my mind is now kind of locked in. It's kind of like in a little kind of box that it's kind of stuck in and is swirling around and caught up in. And I'm kind of disconnected with the rest of my life, the rest of my being. And that can be done so many different ways, to be caught in the world of thoughts, the world of fantasy, the world of projections into the future, the worlds of the past. And those are all belong to that cognitive side of the side of this practice. And it can be very powerful to use our cognition to free us from the cognition, to see, oh, look at that. I'm caught in my thoughts. I'm caught in the past thinking. I'm caught in future thinking. I'm caught in some kind of problem-solving mode. And to really know it can help free us a little bit from it. We're not leaning into it or so committed, just to step out of it and know that this is what's happening. The other side is the part where we feel or sense. The technical word in Buddhism could be to experience, where it's an embodied experience, the sense experience of what's going on. We feel through our body. And I love the idea that we should have translated the word sati, translated as mindfulness. I wish we had translated it as bodyfulness rather than mindfulness. Because I find that over and over again that the reference point for the body is really a very powerful foundation for doing any form of mindfulness practice, including the cognitive part of it. But sometimes we get caught in this, in the feelings. So feelings, sensations, are very strongly a place where we feel emotions. And sometimes the emotions are the train we get on. Sometimes the emotions are the floods we get caught up in. And emotions can come with a certain kind of compulsion or power or influence on us, where also we don't even know that how strongly they're influencing us. It's kind of like maybe a little bit like the mood music in movies that we're not quite listening to the music, but our body is, and we're wondering why we're getting so afraid, and it's because the music is kind of providing that wonderful effect on us. And so we have lots of people in this world now who are providing some equivalent of mood music to try to get our emotions involved. When anybody who uses anger or fear as a medium for what they're talking about, if they're talking about enough anger, have someone to blame, someone else's at fault, or even sometimes angry with you, or so if they use fear to spin stories of how terrible things will be, and they're creating kind of the equivalent of mood music in order to evoke these deep kind of deeper feeling in ourselves. And then we don't even recognize how the emotional states we have are now the lens through which we see the world, the lens to which we interpret what's going on, the lens by which we understand ourselves and what's going on. And it's possible to get trapped in this, in emotions and feelings that are kind of self-perpetuating and so it can go on for a long time. But it's also possible to have the sensing, the experiencing of this be freeing, to drop down and rest in the embodied experience of things. Rest in the making room to feel what we're feeling can help us separate ourselves from it enough that we're not feeding it or picking the wound and scratching it, it more and more, but we're kind of letting it heal or letting it open or settled or reveal itself so we can really see it for what it is without being pushed around or under its influence. And ideally in mindfulness, we're learning how to do both. We're learning that the power of cognition, the power of knowing, seeing clearly, and how that can be freeing, how that can be calming, how that can be clarifying. And we're learning the power of feeling and sensing what's going on, and how that can also be freeing or healing for what's going on. And by going back and forth, we can see a number of things. One is we can see how these two parts of who we are influence each other. That the cognitive part can make fantastically brilliant stories that can frighten you. And I've seen that in myself, that I'm just sitting, minding my own business, having a good time and just being quiet, and that my mind starts making a fantasy. And maybe it's a fantasy of what it's like to be in a car crash. And then my stomach gets tight and I get all tense a little bit and I start, you know, just a fantasy, right? But it should be just kind of left alone up there. But no, my body then kind of takes it up. My body knows, doesn't always know the difference between my fantasy and what's, you know, what's real. And so my body has a response. And my body has a response that I get tense and a little bit frightened in my body. That's just a recipe for having more thoughts about what's frightening in this world. It isn't just car crashes, it's also, you know, shopping cart accidents in Safeway. And you know, who knows? So, you know, with my mind is kind of strange. I don't know if your mind is not strange, but I've realized long ago my mind is a little strange. And probably some of you realize that about me too, so. So, shopping cart accidents. And anyway, so the point being that these two can work together, and that's part of the reason why they can be so powerfully debilitating for people. It's said that, I've said often that rumination is one of the leading causes for depression, probably a leading causes for anxiety, because of the way these things kind of circle and go feed each other, and then the circles go on and on. But these also work together to save us, to liberate us. That the more we can feel sometimes in a relaxed, open way, the more it quiets a thinking mind. And for sometimes that's the case with breathing. To stay and just feel and sense the physicality of breathing, the movements of breath, the sensations of breath, the rhythm of breathing, is sometimes quite calming and settling. That takes the breathing, supports the breathing to settle, but there's a relationship between a settled, calm breathing and our emotional state and our mental state. And you can see it the other way. If I'm sitting, minding my own business and have thoughts about car crashes, my breathing actually changes. My breathing speeds up, it gets a little bit more shallow, it gets a little bit held. But if I free my breathing and let my breathing kind of breathe freely again, the relationship with the mind goes in reverse order, in the worst direction. Now the breathing's helping the mind calm down rather than the tense mind influencing the breathing. So to feel and sense what's going on, to rather than having fear affect the mind to think more fearful thoughts, to discover where the fear is housed in the body. Oh, it's in the belly. So then, okay, let's go down there and feel and sense what's going on in a careful and caring way, where there's a calm awareness of it. Just that assuming control of your mind just enough that you can meet your fear calmly is changing the whole dynamics. You're not being influenced unconsciously or subconsciously or kind of unintendedly, because now you're bringing in a different influence on the ecosystem, a calm attention. And so rather than letting the fear in the belly kind of be the source of more thoughts, now you're using the cognitive ability to stay and feel there, that you're making a breathing room, making room for the fear, So the fear can kind of show itself, be known, be felt, and maybe begin dissolving, maybe begin relaxing. And that affects the mind. And so we're working at this very core material of who we are as human being, our cognitive abilities and sensory abilities, to bring them together to so that we're not the victims of our feelings and our thoughts because we're not paying attention enough. We're paying attention enough that there's a third thing that can happen. There's the cognitive part, there's a sensory part, the feeling part that we have. And the third thing is kind of not something you can, it both doesn't cost anything, but also you wouldn't want to pay anything for it. If someone, you couldn't really buy it. So it probably has no value. So why bother? And the third thing is you create space around what's happening. There's more room. I like to think about creating breathing room. So make breathing room for the fear. Make breathing room for the cognitive mind that's flooded with thoughts. And the idea of space, there's also space here. Just like in this room, there's all of us here in the room, and there's a space in the room. And it's, you know, it's quite a high ceiling. And if you kind of just kind of relax back and look at the ceiling and take it in, the space above, you probably begin shifting a little bit how you feel being here. Same thing happens within us. If there's a feeling of space for all your thoughts, that sense of space, there's something beyond the edges of your thoughts in which the thoughts are happening, that creates more freedom. If there's more space for the emotions we have, the sensations we have in our body, because the space is that which is kind of just beyond the edges of our emotions. Have you ever explored what's beyond the edge of an emotion? Or do you have emotions that fill the universe? They're so big for you that they fill the universe. They were there before so big that they probably were there before the universe began. Or is there an edge? And it's a kind of a strange question because, you know, maybe emotions are not something that have edges. But even the question, it maybe lets us give space, room to feel, to be there. And then to rest in that space or to identify with that space more than we identified ourselves or defined ourselves with our feelings and emotions, more than we identify ourselves or define ourselves by the thoughts, the stories, the memories, the projections of the mind, but identify with the space, not because that's who you truly are, but that's who you can be, that's where you can kind of rest or be in a way that's, again, freeing, that loosens up the grip, loosens up the attachment, loosens things up so, oh, yes, there's more here. There's space here. There's room here. It's the mind that's claustrophobic, that's caught in so many different thoughts and ideas that we don't even know we're caught because we're so distracted by distractions, we don't know we're distracted. Figure that one out. And we're so, you know, lost in it that we don't even know we're lost in thought. But to not be lost in thought, to step back and see it and make room for it, then we're not continually feeding it, recycling it, perpetuating these kinds of trains of thought, floods of thought. And the same thing with emotions. And the remarkable thing that begins happening is that rather than the source of our life activity and our thoughts, our feelings, emotions, and all that belonging to the reactive world, where things are just reacting to one thing after the other, there is a time when we get so settled on ourselves, so grounded here and having space for ourselves, that it's not reactivity that leads the show. It's not attachments that lead what we do, but rather it's something that's deeply generative, deeply some deep kind of growth, some deep suffusion of warmth, of goodness, of wholesomeness, of something that feels nurturing and nourishing for us. And the representative examples of these is something that in the iconography of Indian religions and Buddhism as well is represented by this great god Brahma, kind of the Indian mythology, Buddhist lore, has four faces in which to see the world. And you'll see statues in Asia and sometimes paintings where you have this, you see that this person has a face in the front, a face in the side, and a face in the back of his head. And these four faces represent kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, appreciation, and equanimity. I like to think of them as the four forms of love. And the source of love, the source of kindness, the source of compassion within us, doesn't lend itself to reactivity, doesn't lend itself to be born and to arise and flow through us in this kind of way in which, you know, the floods and trains of thinking were caught up in complex ideas and stories, and doesn't lend itself to be present for us if we're caught and tight in our reactive emotions. It's what can happen when we make space for it all, when we relax and are quiet and make room for the wider functioning of our psychophysical being. Then there's room for these quiet emotions, these quiet social emotions, these quiet, I call them quiet or shy, because they're easily overridden, they're easily lost. And that's one of the advantages of this kind of settling and quieting and bringing the mind and body into harmony, bringing the cognitive side of us and our sensory part of us working together so we really have a good sense of what's here. Then we have space for it all. We make space. In that space, there's room for love. In that space, there's room for friendliness. There's room for a deep care for the challenges that people are in and wanting to help and support. In that space, there's the opportunity for some deep resonance that we can have with the joy and the well-being and the success of people, and share in that joy. And in that deep resonance, there's a way of really loving people, caring about people, and at the same time, not getting caught, not getting contracted, not clinging, not resisting, not kind of drowning in the suffering of the world. And has maybe the unfortunate word in English of equanimity. Unfortunate because very few people in English can associate equanimity with love. So it's almost like we should say equanimous love for this fourth face of Brahma. So it turns out, maybe you don't want this, but you have something like four faces. Maybe four faces of your heart, or the four antennas of your heart. And maybe that can be the third center, in addition to the cognitive and the physical. If you're quiet enough or spacious enough or centered enough, maybe then your heart can work really well. And you'll be ready to meet people in their circumstances as they actually are. Some people you meet as friends with kindness, goodwill. Some people you meet with compassion and sympathy and understanding and caring for them because of their difficulty. Some people you meet with tremendous joy and delight at how it's going well for them. And some people you meet with this quiet, calm way of caring and loving, but you can't really do much more. Sometimes you can't help people who suffer, but you can still love them and be present for them, and that's this equanimous love. So that's where I'll end. That was the whole point of the talk to begin with. It just took me a long time to get there. I wanted to talk about these four Brahma Viharas and we have about 15 minutes. So, and I wonder if some of you would like to make any comments or have questions about anything or. Testimonials. Morgan, if you can.
Hi, I'm Morgan.
That's it, Dawn. You might have to turn it up for me because of my hearing.
Hi, I'm Morgan, and my question is that in the mind. The wandering mind that we talked about earlier, when it's the emotion is fear, it's fairly easy for me to identify it in my body. What if the emotion is desire or clinging? How can you have any tips for how to peel that one apart, other than maybe like I try to trigger myself to get back into the moment?
I think that if desire is problematic, for sometimes desires are a dime a dozen. You know, they just come easily and they can go. But if desires are problematic, very strong compulsive desires, then one option is to go meditate and to do two things. The primary one in mindfulness, to really feel the sense of the physicality of that compulsion. Make room for it, feel it, sense it, recognize the desire without giving into it, and then see what happens. Something might relax if you do that, because desires perpetuate through time, because one way or the other we remain involved in it. Something keeps regenerating it. But if you step back and really feel it, then maybe you're not renewing it all the time, and something deep has a chance to relax. You might look, if it's really, the more compulsive it is, the more you might want to check out and see if there's some other emotion that comes with it. Some desires are propelled, the strength of them have to do with our fear, the strength of them has to do with our loneliness, the strength of it might be because how uncomfortable we are with being uncomfortable. And so we're kind of generating some this compulsion to get away from something we don't want to have and substitute it or get distracted or something. So to really stop and take a good look and feel it and breathe with it is quite good. The other is to put yourself in a situation for some people where you're safe to feel it because you're not going to give into it. I've been told of people who are alcoholic have a real problem, who have been given the instructions that if they have a strong desire for alcohol, to find a nice chair to sit in, like maybe a recliner, so it's comfortable, and be committed 200% not to leave the recliner, no matter how strong the screaming desire demand for alcohol is. And people told me they've done this, and they describe it as the authority, the power, the insistence of these desires can be quite strong. But if they hang on to the recliner, that the wave gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and then it crests and breaks, and they find themselves in the back of the wave, and things are calm. So I don't, you know, so if you... Is that more than you asked for?
Thank you.
Do you want to say more?
More is better. It's good. It's good.
Yes, it is.
Yes, thank you.
Yesterday I was struggling with the helplessness and despair when this shooting in engineering building on Brown University happened, because I have two grandchildren that are at the college age, and they're in college, and the notion of them being essentially at risk was something I couldn't deal with very well, and the fear and despair just took over my body yesterday when this happened. I was wondering if you have any comment about how to deal with something like this.
I think there's maybe two very important ways to address this. First is what your need is in the moment when it first happens. Maybe you need to find a friend to be with and go for a walk. Maybe you need to call your relatives there and find out if they're okay. Maybe there might be an immediate need for something, just to stabilize and get grounded, and so you don't keep spinning out and making it worse for yourself. And for some people, that might be accomplished by meditating. Some people recognize by meditation that stabilizes them enough that they're not caught in these things in a way that is problematic. The second is at some point, and maybe not this month or right away, but to take this seriously, the strength by which you reacted to this probably has to do with other things in your life besides the event itself. There were other conditions that set you up to really have this go deeper. So I don't want to say anything about for you, but there's a lot of different possibilities that really warrant you to kind of stop and take a deeper look at this, or bring your practice to this other deeper parts that are always there but had never been attended to. So, for example, I mean, it might be that someone was, and when they were in college 40 years ago, there was a shooting then on their college, and the fear that elicited, or the hurt, or the child helplessness that elicited back then, never really got resolved. And this new shooting then has reawoken that. And so it's the first one 40 years ago that really still needs to be healed or settled. It might be for some reason there's a feeling in general that for the way a person's life has unfolded, the person might feel kind of helpless about things. And so when something terrible happens, you feel like it evokes that helplessness, and it can make the fear or the distress much bigger than it has to be. We get caught in it. So it might be at some point, once you feel stabilized and cared for, and maybe you go for a walk with a caring, compassionate friend, he hears you out, you have a chance to talk about this, at some point you might feel there's something deeper that warrants some kind of meeting that. And then spend some time practicing with that. Is that okay?
Very helpful. Thank
you. Hi. One thing you said today really struck me, which was meet your fear calmly. I think that's so important. I've been really stressed lately, which is not my normal way of being. And when you said that, I realized that there's a big difference between the things I need to do and the, oh my God, that I'm adding on top of it. And if I can just focus on the things that need to be done, I'm really good at doing things. So, you know, I can just be calm about that and give away the, oh my God. That's, I'm adding that on top. So I really appreciate you, your saying that and
great.
Helping that to pop into my mind.
And that was well said. That was really well said, how you said it. And part of what's the possibility of this practice as we mature in the practice or develop in the practice is there's less and less extra added. Life without extras. Oh, yes. Let's see if we can... For those of you online, I haven't forgotten about you.
So, Cindy online, she's asked, they're asking how we can make room for grief when it's physically and mentally taking over, especially this time of the year. They also mentioned that, you know, they're feeling... loss of their son right now.
Lots of death?
Loss, yeah.
Lots of loss. So how to make room for grief this time of year? Well, that's a, you know, of course, all these questions are very, all these comments and questions, you know, I can't help but to hear them as representing very, very important and tender and touching parts of the heart of your inner life and something like grief, of course. I don't, you know, it's a, you know, I certainly would like to be able to respond in a way that is caring and appropriate. You know, it's hard to know in a short question like that. But I think grief is something that really warrants our mindfulness. It warrants kind of giving room and time for our grief, partly so that we can allow our heart to do its natural work with our grief. The heart knows how to grieve, believe it or not. Even though it can feel so painful. And so to give room and learn mindfulness well enough that we can be present for these difficult emotions without adding all the extra that we add, the fear, the judgments, the shame, the resistance, the, you know, running away, closing down, shutting up, all kinds of ways in which we kind of add these extra layers and layers and layers. It shouldn't be this way, or blaming someone for it, or whatever it might be, to relax and relax so that we can let some of these emotions to be there in the closest to what I might call their natural simplicity and the natural simplicity of grief. Sometimes that really supported by having a good friend or someone we can talk to, maybe a grief counselor, so that someone who's not afraid of grief or reactive to grief or someone who's not going to fix you and tell you what you should do, but someone who's willing to just listen and be with you and accompany you, be a companion in the grief. Sometimes there's a time and place for grief. Some people, it's kind of wise to know that this is not the time. Maybe right now I should be distracted. Maybe I have responsibilities to take care of, but I have to make time later. I'm not ready yet, but sometime I'll sit with it and be with it. But I think that there are times where I feel that grief is sacred. And I say that to people who are grieving sometimes so that they can hear a very different message about a grief than what they often get kind of subconsciously from our society or family or whatever, that somehow you're not supposed to grieve, you're supposed to be over it, or, you know, you have to kind of move on from it. And grief is a very, very important part of being human. It's not a mistake. It's not exactly wrong. It's tragic sometimes, the reasons for it. But to see it as sacred, to give space to that, to feel that, and make special time, high-quality time for the grief. And exactly what high-quality time is varies from person to person. Sometimes what's really helpful is a ritual. Memorial services can be helpful if it's someone has died. I give people little rituals to do, and if they're grieving something on a retreat that I teach, and it's really, you know, really big for them, their grief, whatever it might be. I might, if we're meeting outside for these discussions I do, I might go pick up a little stone and give them a stone. Let this be your grief. Carry it around for a while, for a few days, and let that kind of accompany you and place your grief there in your thoughts. And then when you feel ready, have a little ritual where you, maybe find a place on the property where you can bury it and wish it well and let it be well tucked in here at the retreat center, and it's safe here for it, and maybe you'll be ready to put it down or leave it or entrust it someplace, your grief. So something like that. It varies from person to person what I say, but sometimes a ritual can be helpful. And anyway, so that's okay. Those are my thoughts. So here we are with the four faces of love. And some of what arose in your questioning is the face of compassion and care. But when I was coming down here and sitting down with all of you this morning, it was the face of joy, delight that we're here doing this, and the face of friendliness, metta. And I wonder if, because we're having a tea today, it will take maybe, 3-4 minutes for you, if you don't mind. You don't have to, you can just sit and close your eyes and meditate or get up and go. But maybe introduce yourself to two people next to you. Maybe say hello and introduce yourself and say something that you know about any one of these four faces of love. Just one word or two words or something. Like, it's a good idea or something. So please, and then I'll ring a bell in a few minutes.